You're listening to Lavender Language with your host, me, Adrian Ramirez. On the final episode of the second season of Lavender Language, we're speaking with journalist Amelia Abraham. Amelia has written for such publications as Vogue, The Guardian, ID, and The Sunday Times, and has worked as an editor for Dazed, Refinery 29, and Vice. Her first book, Queer Intentions, came out in 2019, which chronicles her journey navigating questions of modern queer life. She is currently working on her second book, We Can Do Better Than This, scheduled for a summer 2021 release. We chatted with Amelia to discuss her life before journalism, writing her first book, and the reinvention of Pride since the worldwide effects of COVID-19.
Hi, Amelia.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Welcome to Lavender Language.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start this interview off, and I hope this doesn't embarrass you too much, but I wanted to start it off with reading a quote from one of my favorite articles that you've written.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's from 2014, actually.
Oh, wow, the archive.
Yes. So
I've done a deep dive.
Honey, we did a deep dive, and I found some great treasures in there. So the article was called Female Trouble was the film that made me realize I could be a wretched little slut.
Okay, I'm actually really happy that someone's found that because I'm quite proud of that article, mostly the headline.
I could get away with writing something like that, like it would be mwah, chef's kiss, amazing.
Well,
it's
no, you
such
could.
A great title.
I wrote a lot of things in 2014 I'm not proud of, and I wasn't sure what you were going to say, so I'm really, really happy that it's that.
Well, this is why I love this one so much, because obviously Female Trouble is iconic. It was really great, and so I'm just going to read a little bit from it, if that's okay.
Sure, thanks.
There comes a moment like this in most young adolescent lives, when the burning realization hits that you're far more fabulous than everyone else. More talented and better looking than all the nauseating kids in your class, and destined to leave the drudgery of your suburban existence behind. Problem is, your glamour is smothered by your parents, by your teachers, and by anyone else who thinks they can stick their nose in. These people try to impress upon you their arbitrary rules. Sit with your legs together. You're a young lady. What have I said about stealing? Will you at least try to be heterosexual? They condition you while you're young, socialize you, deny you your egomania. They want you to grow up to be a nice, well-meaning person, living a quiet life in a four-bed semi where you die in your sleep, a speck of dust in the ether of existence. What John Waters is interested in, I think, is the moment when you break free from these rules and constraints and burst out glittering and ugly from the realm of right into wrong. Everyone in Waters' world deserves a life of notoriety, and nowhere is the sentiment better expressed than in his film, Pink Flamingos, an exercise in what happens when you allow that tiny glimmer of fuck you in the corner of your eye to blossom into a maniacal, shit-smeared grin.
It was just so fantastic. It really took me on a journey.
Thank you.
I loved it, and just I really related as well.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's easy to write effusively about John Waters' work because I love it so much.
It absolutely is. And then you got the chance to interview him, correct?
Yeah, I've actually interviewed him twice, and it's been great both times.
He's absolutely lovely.
He is so lovely and really, really, really funny. He really delivers. You know, he's exactly as you'd expect. He's such a good speaker. He's so articulate. The only problem is that he's almost so good at doing his own PR that he sometimes sort of says the same thing to you as he'll say to another journalist on the same press run. So you've got to be quite careful that he hasn't sort of, he'll say something dazzlingly witty and then you'll realize that he said that to, you know, two other journalists as well. But he's brilliant.
That's really interesting because obviously you interview people for a living as well as write your own books and your own articles, but you also interview people and you must come across that a lot in trying to like in interviewing people who are so well versed in the art of the interview. And like you said, you kind of have to be quite careful of maybe, I don't know, being discerning about the kind of more rehearsed answers that can be given during an interview.
Yeah, I think so. Although I would say that I'm definitely more interested in trying to find people that haven't been interviewed a whole bunch. Mm. And I suppose being around people who are very good at being interviewed or very slick and kind of articulate and professional, at least there's hopefully a positive in that it maybe rubs off. Because, yeah, when I wrote my first book and it came out last year, for this, it was very strange for the first time to be interviewed instead of doing the interviewing.
Right.
But I would hope that being exposed to people like John Waters and seeing how they do it is helpful, I guess. You would hope, in training you up. Yeah.
So before we get into your first book, I'd like to know a bit about kind of your growing up. Like, where did you come from? Where did you grow up and what your childhood was like?
Well, that's so funny. Nobody ever asks me that.
it's interesting because I think even in that little bit of the article that I read, I think it says a lot about who you are in that moment. Like, as much as you're talking about his work and what that kind of can mean for somebody, I think it says a lot about maybe where you come from as well, but more internally.
Yeah. And I was about to say, it's probably just as well that no one ever asked me that because, you know, as the article probably indicates, I don't think it was, it's not sort of super interesting. I'm from Northwest London, and then I grew up with my mum just in the countryside, mostly outside of London. And my parents were never together since I was born. So I was sort of split my time between visiting my dad and being with my mum. And, you know, both my parents are from working class backgrounds, but I had quite a middle class, sort of quite ordinary English upbringing. And there weren't, you know, loads of sort of queer people in my life, where I don't think I was exposed to a great deal of diversity. And I was always a real tomboy and spent a lot of time alone. Because I grew up without any brothers and sisters in my house. My dad had other kids, but I was on my own. So I basically just played football alone all the time, like a true proto-lesbian child. PlayStation and football and, like, throwing rocks at things. And
classic lesbian.
Yeah, classic lesbian child. Not that I really knew it yet. And then I guess the other thing I would say is that I didn't grow up in a sort of particularly academic or intellectual or bourgeois. It was quite sort of like suburban, pull your socks up. You know, nobody in my family was a great reader, and we didn't really have books in our house, or reading wasn't particularly encouraged. So I do think, in a way, you know, they're not really, my parents aren't really, as I said, they're both quite working class. They're not. And not that you can't be working class and an intellectual, of course you can, but they weren't of that sort of ilk. And
Right. So
the fact that I even went to university, you know, neither of them did that. And the fact even more so that I've gone on to write books is quite strange, because, we just didn't grow up in a house where, like, books were really a thing. Maybe yes. The sort of odd John Grisham book or something like
right.
that.
Right. So how did you find writing? Or was it something that you were maybe exposed to in school that you just kind of took to? Or did you always kind of have, like, a natural sort of talent for it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I didn't like it in school. I was really naughty and just smoked weed all the time and never did my homework and never did my... even then, when I got to university, I never did my coursework until, like, morning it was due, and just sort of dreaded it.
Same.
If you leave it to the last possible minute, it will sort of science mathematically get done in the shortest amount of time.
I agree.
I wasn't really that interested, but I do think I was slightly interested in the career of being a journalist, because I really like meeting people, and it seemed quite glam from what I could ascertain. I mean, I can safely say now it's not that glam.
Where did you kind of get your idea of it being glam?
Well, I think when I was a little bit old, my mum had a boyfriend who at one point sort of would read all the Sunday buy all the Sunday papers, you know, sort of like hot, right, the probably quite right wing ones that I wouldn't want to read now, but reading the supplements in there and understanding that a job was just to basically interview famous people for like the Sunday newspaper supplement, to me I was like, well, that seems like quite a glamorous job. You're sort of, it seems really interesting actually.
Definitely.
And I was quite interested in it, but I think that I didn't necessarily think that it was something I could do, but that sort of put the idea in my head. And then simultaneously at university, I did a module on queer studies.
Okay.
And
yeah,
that was just totally life changing. I was so interested in gender and sexuality, and I was like, this is the first time academia has actually truly, really, 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 really like excited me.
I felt the same way. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It was like reading Judith Butler, kind of like, I don't know, what's performative? It like just completely opened, like blew my mind.
Exactly. Yeah, me too. And so you can sort of see how those things eventually converged. But it took a little while to get there. When I left university, all I knew that I cared about was sort of like, I was really, really interested in queer cinema. So the first thing I did was an internship for a really long time, and sort of like supported myself by working in retail at the UK's only queer film distributor. It's called Peccadillo Pictures.
Yeah, of course, Peccadillo, yeah.
Yeah, and so I basically just emailed them until they would have me come in. and I worked there for a while and I really, really enjoyed it. And I was doing basically PR there, film PR. And then a little while after that, I got a job at Vice doing PR for Vice. And then I started writing on the side while I was doing that. And then eventually a job came up in editorial at Vice and I applied for it and moved over to editorial. And that's how I started as a journalist. So I was about, I would say 23 then.
Wow. That is so impressive. That's so great.
Well, that's the story.
Were you kind of thinking of this like, this is the kind of career that I want and this is how I'm going to get it? So it seemed very much like you were able to follow a trajectory, or were you just sort of stumbling upon these things and kind of going for them?
I would say that when you work as a PR, you obviously spend a lot of your time talking to journalists and around journalists and learning about how journalists do their job. So I think that process gave me a lot of understanding of what the job actually entails. And also working at Vice, where a lot of people, you know, I had friends on the editorial team. So it sort of demystified what that job would be like. And I think it slightly helped absolve my imposter syndrome. It was also really helpful in that, I met a lot of journalists that worked across the media at different publications, and they were really encouraging and kind and were like, you could do this if you wanted to. So I think that it all fell into place quite organically rather than being a kind of grand plan. And I will say that for its various shortcomings and complications, Vice is a great place to be a young journalist, because there are no rules, you know, for better or worse. They'll throw you into jobs that you might not be experienced enough for, and that's how you learn. Or they let you write things like that article that you read out at the beginning of the podcast, which, you know, perhaps wouldn't find its way into a broadsheet, I suspect. So it was a really good place to be at that time, and I am quite grateful that that's where I got my start. And I think the just turn up and do it attitude to journalism has been quite helpful in terms of book writing later. I'm a bit loath to use the term gonzo journalism, but I was sort of schooled within that arena when I worked at Vice, because it was of course about 2013-14. So I it, I think that leaves you with a certain way of doing things. And I think that, you know, the way I wrote my book, Queer Intentions, is quite like, oops, I got drunk on the job, or, oh, this went totally wrong because I didn't plan it enough. And I think deciding to leave those things in was partly to do with, because it feels like, you know, a bit more messy and relatable, but also because that's sort of how I was taught to write.
I mean, I think it does its job for sure, because like you said, you are very honest about, in the book, you talk about going to Pride in Berlin and you miss the Dyke March.
Yeah.
And your whole thing is like, the fuck, I literally came to Berlin to do this and I missed it. But you end up talking to people anyways, and that's kind of how you sort of find your way to getting these conversations that are maybe even a bit more helpful to the point that you're trying to make.
Well, hopefully it's at least honest. I think what, you know, is quite interesting about writing a book is that unless you're kind of super famous and have had a large sum of money thrown at you to do what you're doing, you're actually sort of operating, you know, around the economics of time, and you're sort of working on the side, and you're going to do these research trips, spending as little money as you possibly can. And, you know, trying to be there long enough to really get the story, but also not stay too long, because you need to kind of get back to reality and earn a bit of money. So, you know, it is quite high stakes if things fuck up, because you're like, I'm only here for four more days, or I can't wait till next year to do this again at Pride, or, you know. So it was quite stressful in moments, but it did seemingly kind of all work out in the end. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I had to work with things going wrong, because there wasn't the sort of time or sort of financial leeway to rethink or re-report.
Do you think that you were kind of always more inclined to work in that sort of way? I mean, you kind of said in university you had this way of kind of working at the last minute, but making it work, essentially. I mean, you graduated, right? And then, you know, with your book, maybe things didn't go right, but it's all about kind of like rolling with the punches and just kind of making do with what you have and making it work, because it has to work. You have there's very little leeway. It's not a vacation, so you just have to get it done. Do you think like things in your past have helped make you prepared to write this book?
Yeah, I think perhaps we can at least say that, you know, it's a reflection of my character, which is probably a little bit scrappy, a little bit sort of missing in too many places at once. I think as a Gemini, I'm always trying to do like six things not well.
Oh my God, I'm a Gemini moon. So honey, I feel that on a very deep level. Yes, I'm a Pisces with a Gemini moon. So honey, watch out.
Oh, that's a really nice combination, I think.
Thank you. what's your moon sign? This is totally off topic.
What? It's really bad that I don't know this. I think Libra.
Okay.
Which you would expect to bring some balance and organization.
Yeah, a bit more balance. But honey, at least you said you get it. You get your work done, right? So maybe the chaos leads to the path.
Yeah, we get there in the end. I think.
In mathematics, randomness is considered a pattern.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely method to madness. But, you know, I finished it exactly, got there in the end. And I think it makes sense. I suppose also the decision to write a book where I travel to all these different places and there is a bit more room for things to go wrong. Because a lot of it is left up to chance, right? You go to a place and you see what happens and then you write about it. That is almost a bit selfish in a way, because to me that just sounds so much more fun than writing a book.
It sounds a bit glam. It sounds very glam.
Always striving for the glam. Well, was it? I actually really don't think it was. I was like staying in like the cheapest, shittiest hostel.
Yes.
In, like,
no, you're very honest, grade. For sure.
Or like sleeping on a friend's couch or whatever, or getting any, you know, there's multiple EasyJet flights in that book.
Right.
That are discussed.
Yes. There's something very kind of true to the queer spirit. Is almost, it's very, and the experiences that you've had in the book that you write about, meeting strangers and then them taking you on their journey, that you're able to kind of dissect and write about. So when you go to LA, you kind of just go, you don't have very much money, but you go anyways. And you end up meeting a drag queen there that you go to drag con with, and they kind of tell you about their story and that sort of all by chance as well. And I feel like you find community in every place that you go to.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
it seems that that's something that's quite important to you. I mean, in your writing, at least, you talk about that a lot.
It is really important. I hope that reading the book, it does feel like that experience of, you know, I mean, nights out aren't for everyone, but that thing of sort of, you know, going to a gay bar and meeting someone and sort of then going off somewhere else with them, and the sort of like romanticism of that happen chance. Is that a word? I think it's a word. Encounters. It may or may not be a word. And just the kind of, the randomness and the, it's quite sporadic. And it really did happen that way. Obviously there was a bit of pre-planning. There was a bit of, who am I going to talk to? How am I going to do this? Like, what is the story going to be here? There had to be some of that. And I was lucky in that a few of the chapters are based on things I'd written about before. So I'd written an article, for instance, about trans models, and so Peshe D, who founded the New York trans model agency called Trans Models, was someone I'd interviewed for this article. So, you know, we already had a connection, and Peshe had agreed that I could kind of talk to her when I was in New York. So there were some things like that. And then there were some things of like, oh, I don't know anyone in Serbia who's LGBT. So I'm, you know, how am I going to do this? Sometimes that would involve finding an LGBT organization. Actually, in that case, what happened was I emailed Vice Serbia, two of the people that worked there were sort of not queer themselves, but allies. And they were really passionate about LGBT rights in Serbia. And they basically said, wow, like nobody comes here to report on this or particularly cares about our situation. You know, it's really underreported, so we'd love to help you. And I think that, in coming back to this point on community, I think there's two things. You know, I think people do feel like, well, you know, like we're a family, like you're another queer person, like I will help you. There's a willingness there. There's this feeling of connection. And then these were people that really care themselves. You know, a lot of the people in the book are sort of activists or have been oppressed. So they have a vested interest in LGBT rights and the subject matter.
So let's talk about, actually, I mean, we've been talking about queer intentions, but I'd like to kind of talk about the inception of it and kind of how it felt to have your first book commissioned.
It felt good and it felt surreal.
Yeah.
The inception of it, it did feel quite natural. I mean, it still felt surreal to be writing a book, but in one sense, but it also felt like a bit of an amalgamation of a lot of different bits of work I've been doing or articles I've been writing over the years. So while it felt surreal on the one hand, it also felt quite like natural on the other hand.
Well, I think that even comes across in the book. Like, it doesn't ever feel like, hi, I'm going to start writing a book. The kind of beginning of the book talks about a relationship that you have and kind of how that breaks down and how that leaves you in an emotional state. And it almost feels like that's what kind of gives you like the push to all of a sudden find community again and maybe start thinking about the LGBTQ plus community as a whole. And I wonder if that is where it started or if had you had the idea already to write this book?
Yeah, I had had the idea already. I had been thinking about lots of things I've been seeing happening. So for instance, you know, gay bars I loved closing, drag kind of becoming quite mainstream and maybe feeling slightly less sort of underground or subversive, pride being corporatized, trans people on magazines, as I mentioned. And basically all these different signals of sort of the mainstreaming of queer culture. And also, of course, you know, the biggest of all, same-sex marriage, right? Like, since and I sort of saw same-sex marriage being legalized in Britain in 2014 as the kind of crux of all these changes or a turning point. And so there, I'd written articles about each of these things separately. But it was really clear to me that they were kind of connected in this weird moment that we were in, as queer culture was being mainstreamed, basically, moving sort of like from sort of underground or hidden shadows into sort of like a more visible or slightly acceptable, at least on the surface of things, space.
Yes.
So the kind of hypothesis was there, and I was like, I haven't really read a book about this. I have read academic queer theory books about assimilation, you know, and they're all published on university presses and they're, you know, amazing. They're some of my favorite books. It's not to say that there isn't a really long history of writing about assimilation. There's a great book called The Trouble with Normal by Michael Warner, which is just the most incredible book about like respectability politics and the fight for same-sex marriage and stuff like that, and Avashi Vaid's work as well. So there's quite a lot of writing on this. I just felt like there wasn't something that was in a non-academic space on it and was really looking at it in a more cultural way, specifically pinned to these more recent things that were happening. The sort of argument was there. And then when I had this breakup, it also felt relevant to the argument because it was a kind of, on a personal level, I was experiencing what I was seeing to be happening on a wider level. So I was sort of seeing this sort of like, you know, inverted commas, selling out of like radical queer politics. And on a personal level, I had got into this relationship, which was actually quite heteronormative, and started thinking about making quite heteronormative choices in my own life. Like, would I get same-sex married? So it felt like there was a connect between the personal and the political, which there always is. And that's why I decided to write about both.
You know, you saying that there is lots of kind of academic writing on the assimilation of queerness in the mainstream. And I loved the chapter where you talked about same-sex marriage and kind of meeting this couple who had kind of were trying to become like the first same-sex married couple in Camden? Was it like all of London or Camden specifically?
Well, I think they were trying to be the first in the UK, but loads of couples were trying to be the first. So there was this like weird race to be the first.
I loved that. And it's interesting because it's my 5th year anniversary today, and I'm American, but my husband is from the UK. And so that really struck a chord with me because it was like the couple, one was from the UK and one was from America, correct? So
yeah, and also congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's strange because
I want to ask you a question, which was, what was it like to read that chapter as a married queer person?
I felt really seen, actually. It was interesting. It was interesting reading it. I really felt, you know, these were all questions that I was asking myself as well. Like I was really kind of connected to this idea of me being a queer person. So kind of like subverting all these normal expectations of who I could be in the world. And then I met somebody and it was like, I guess I'm going to get married. Like it was so strange, but it also felt so normal. So these topics that you're covering are all pressing issues to me personally as a queer person who's living in, you know, 2020. And, you know, had I read this when I was a teenager, it would have completely changed my life. I mean, I think when I was like 15, I was reading Faggots by Larry Kramer. And I was like, oh my God, like, this is what I have to look forward to. Like, that is wild. That's not really the reality anymore. And so this really great study on the full spectrum of queer life now, which is not so doom and gloom. It's beautiful. And sometimes it's still really hard. And also, you know, what happens when we kind of get more into the mainstream and we are more, quote unquote, accepted? What does that actually mean?
And I guess it it is important to say for anyone who might be listening that hasn't read it, you know, it isn't just about, as you mentioned, mainstreaming or acceptance. It's sort of asking, how far does that really go?
Yeah.
Is it a bit of a, you know, a bit of a trick in some senses?
And yes, exactly. Because, you know, you mention in the book about how it is now widely accepted that we can get married, but do we actually feel safe holding hands in public? Every day we feel more accepted, but it always feels like we're at an arm's length from actually full acceptance, or I don't know, respect. It's like we are accepted, but are we respected?
Yeah, I would say that since I wrote it, obviously there have been some horrific things happening in terms of rollbacks of LGBT rights. And so,
yes.
I mean, that's happening all the time, but it's just, it's becoming like acutely awful. And I do write in the book about violence towards trans women of color, but actually when I wrote that, it was 2000 and I want to say the end, right at the end of 2017.
Okay.
And here we are in 2020 and the situation hasn't gotten any better. It's just as bad, or yes, maybe even a little worse. I mean, it's definitely getting more attention now on social media, yeah, which is great.
Absolutely.
So that's good. But yeah, it's just awful. And so I think the kind of chasm between rights on paper and safety is obviously still there, but equally we're actually losing rights on paper too.
Yes. Very much so.
It is constantly changing. And I think one thing that is hard when you write a book about a landscape that is constantly changing is trying to sort of anticipate how it will change, or, you know, write something that will feel relevant for like a little while. So I tried to do that. I tried quite hard to do that, but then it's actually become quite depressing, you know, that how relevant a lot of it feels, just because things are staying the same.
One of the things that you write about in the chapter, which is entitled "What Have We Got to Be Proud Of," is pride, is the pride parade and the kind of co-opting of that by corporations. Obviously, the past few years, it's kind of gotten increasingly worse, you know, with people who are just trying to pinkwash their identities and their brands, but, you know, not actually doing anything that's helping the LGBTQ community. And obviously this year, 2020, because of, due to coronavirus, it was canceled in a sense. But, you know, on the day of Pride, I attended the Black Trans Lives Matter March, and it felt like the truest version of what Pride actually is at its core than I've ever felt. And I wonder what your kind of take on that is.
My take on that is, I'm so glad that you went, and I really wish I had gone. I couldn't go because I had to quarantine at that time. And I've heard that from other people, that it was kind of, yeah, the truest form of what it should feel like. And I'm so happy to hear that. I think I felt that about, was it? So I guess last year, mm-hmm, 2019, mm-hmm, when we sort of, there was a kind of like anti-Pride protest alongside the main event, which was basically a protest against the corporatization of Pride. And also a lot of people were invited to give political speeches because there was this feeling that kind of grassroots organizations or community activists didn't really have like a voice or a stage at main Pride. And this was in London. And it was great. I felt like this is the closest I've ever felt to Pride. And then we sort of march behind the main parade chanting, "We're here, we're queer, we are not going shopping," which is a good one. And I, you know, I find the main parade a bit depressing. It's just, there's just so, yes, many logos, you know?
Yeah.
So I felt really similarly. I don't know this year. I didn't, obviously a lot of things have happened online and I haven't gone to any of them. Maybe that's bad. Maybe I should be interested. It would have been sort of sociologically interesting to see what these digital Pride events look like.
Yeah. Well, yes, it's also interesting to the queer experience that like where there's a will, there's a way. And us as a queer community have always found a way to just make it work and to be seen in our own way, whether or not that's on a global level or like a more mainstream level, that people always find a way.
Yeah, I mean, there was the Global Pride, which was, I don't know, like so many countries, maybe like almost 100 or something, doing a kind of 24-hour live stream. And I know that New York and San Francisco and various other prides did online events. And then a few kind of queer publications did online events, like Them US and Pink News in the UK. But I, as I say, I didn't go to the Pride Black Trans Lives Matter protest, but I had been to quite a lot of Black Lives Matter protests before that, you know, carrying a banner that says Black Trans Lives Matter. And so I think that when you've been going to these IRL protests, maybe the idea of watching some kind of like live stream of a drag queen feels like less urgent use of your time or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Not to drag anybody else, but like, it's true. Yeah. I totally agree.
Well, I think one thing that's exciting is that with digital prides, and I interviewed the guys that were running Denmark Copenhagen Pride online, they were like, it's really good that we've been forced to make this digital in some ways, because it's making us think about how to make this parade more accessible in the long run. And so we'll how we can help people, you know, with access issues or disability issues or from rural areas or who are in closets, all these different things, how we can make pride, how we can help it reach them, and really think quite critically about that. So I think there are definitely positives from the fact that it went online.
So maybe like the cancellation of the actual event, but the protests happening with the Black Lives Matter movement, it feels right.
It does. I think that any queer person who saw those images of 15,000 people wearing all white in Brooklyn coming to, you know, a vigil for Black trans lives would, you know, I was moved to tears. Like I'm sure that you are, you know, and I don't remember, I've never been to kind of corporate pride and been moved to tears
never.
or felt that actual sense of pride. Like the clue is in the name, you know? And so I think that it was a turning point. I think it was like, it like really showed us like what that, you know, those images. And I'm sure the one in London showed us what pride should be. And a friend of mine, an activist called Adam Eli, who I follow, he's wonderful and everybody listening should follow him. But I, you know, that's where I get a lot of my kind of, because he's always out on the street, you know, he's always platforming other people, and that's where I get a lot of my kind of information or snippets of what's going on in America or specifically New York. And you know, watching his stories at the different protests outside Stonewall and from that day and from other things has been it's filled me with pride. And he's actually written an essay for the new book I'm editing where he really beautifully talks about the different prides he's seen in his lifetime and what pride means, and why June 2020 has set out like a new blueprint for pride. And so
that's what I'm hoping.
That's wonderful. Mm. He's put it much more articulately than I have.
I want to talk about your second book. Well, one, congratulations. That's so amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good. It's mostly good because I don't have to write all of it.
Yes. So it's called We Can Do Better Than This, and it's an anthology of queer rights. And you're having many writers contribute to it. And I wonder if you could name some of them.
Yeah. So there's a mixture of people that do different things. There's some writers, some activists, some musicians, and people that are sort of like all of those things, artists. It's kind of queer theorists, performers. It's a great mix. Who are some of the people? Well, Adam, who is a great Jewish queer activist. My friends Tom Rasmussen and Amru Al-Qadi, who've both written brilliant books. Tom's is called Diary of a Drag Queen, and Amru's is called Unicorn. And those both came out last year as well, actually. So they're both in it. And Beth Ditto is in it, which is
fantastic.
Great. Yeah. Mickey Blanco, Owen Jones, which is also great. So yeah, I feel really blessed. We've got some we've got some really good people. I would say what unites everyone is that there are no apolitical gays. It's a really broad church, and there's so many queer people of color and trans and non-binary writers. I think that what unites everyone is that they are like really active and really outspoken and like quite angry. And I wouldn't say that the tone of the book is angry. It is in places, but I there is sometimes pressure when you're doing a book like that to sort of like go for the biggest names. And Penguin has been pretty understanding about, you know, like me saying, I don't want to ask that person to be in it because it's not enough to just be LGBT. Like, I only want people in this who are trying to make life better for LGBT people or speak up on issues that affect LGBT people.
I love what you say about kind of there's no one who's apolitical in it. And, you know, it's funny to me that there are kind of gay queer people who find themselves to be apolitical, because I really do believe that there is no removing politics from our identities and who we are, because we've been politicized. You know, our identities are political. Who we are political. So I think that's really interesting.
Well,
I really look forward to reading it.
Thank you. Well, yeah, I mean, I was talking about that with Beth Ditto when we chatted, and she was like, what do those gays think about? I think there was some really interesting discourse in the media around what it means to be a kind of apolitical gay, or kind of minimize your gayness, or be gay rather than queer, because we use those terms interchangeably, but like they are different things, and they all have meanings to different people. But I was going to say that there was quite a lot of interesting discussion around that, I think, with the US president, like the Pete Buttigieg. I never know how you say his name.
Buttigieg.
Yeah, Pete, there you Buttigieg. Go. Thank you. I was running up to it. I was like, oh no, you never know how you say this, but thank God I have you. So I was reading so much interesting stuff about him when he was running online. And I think that really made me think about like, what does it mean to be gay and what does it mean to be queer? And I guess that idea of how can you be apolitical when your whole identity is politicized? But I guess, you know, some people exist in a privilege bubble.
Well, that's it, right? It's privilege. And so that's where it's so interesting. I just had a conversation yesterday with a friend who was saying, a gay white man, and he was saying, you know, I'm just not that interested in identity politics. And
yeah,
I thought, oh, how nice for you. Of course you don't. Like, what? Yeah, why would you? You're a white, cisgendered, heteropassing gay man. Like, there is no one in your way. Why would it matter to you? I mean, it should. I'm not saying it shouldn't, but it upset me, but it didn't surprise me.
I mean, I think that I've heard that a lot, especially when I sort of meet those type of people and, you know, tell them I've written a book about this topic. And, you know, I definitely hear it a lot. And I think sometimes I think that comes from people suppress parts of their identity because of shame. And it's really interesting to think about how shame kind of intertwines with assimilation or kind of acting in a more heteronormative way. And, you know, I always try and forgive people everything. So maybe I'm doing that. But I think a lot of apolitical gays I've had conversation with, I'm like, even this conversation is making you uncomfortable. Like, the part of you is gay the part of you that is gay makes you feel uncomfortable. So to say, oh, the fact that I'm gay doesn't have to make me different, or it doesn't have to be a large part of who I am, is could be to do with that. And then I would also say that I don't think it's always privilege. I think I've been thinking about this a lot in other contexts recently, but I think that when you're just trying to survive, it can be really hard to kind of think about identity politics or like have the kind of emotional or physical space to sort of like intellectualize your own identity or to do activism. especially if, or maybe if you've always been told that your voice isn't important or doesn't matter, then speaking out isn't possible. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things going on there.
I think that's actually very fair and true. Yeah, I agree. I do agree. It's probably better to be a bit more understanding than just angry.
Yeah. And that's why we keep doing what we're doing. We're kind of trying to hammer, get through to those different types of people.
Right.
And try and make them care. But, you know, it's actually a question I ask in Career Intentions, isn't it? It's like, you know, not everyone can be an activist. Like some people are just trying to get by. And on the flip side of that, is it, you know, in the chapter about marriage, I'm kind of thinking, at what point, I think the line is something like, at what point are we allowed to sit back and enjoy the rights we've won? You know, do we always have to be fighting for the next frontier? And does everybody have to be politically active? Or can you just lead like a quiet married life as a gay couple? I would say at the moment, while so many queer people are dying, it's the former, and it should be the former, but it's a really interesting sort of intellectual question, or I don't know. I think people will have different opinions on that.
I think it's a really good question to ask. I mean, this is kind of not off topic. I mean, it's in the same vein, but I've just finished watching that show, Mrs. America, which is about, you know, the second wave of feminism and people like Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan and all these women who were like so hardcore and like fighting like hell for women's rights. But obviously that wave sort of died a bit. It's like, just because they kind of got certain things done then in the 60s, early 70s, late 80s or whatever, they like the fight didn't stop, right? Like they didn't win equality for women, and something like misogyny has ended. So, you know, we have to keep fighting always, because there's always going to be somebody disenfranchised. There's always going to be somebody marginalized. And if we then are all of a sudden finding ourselves in places of comfort, well, it's only because of people who, well, especially in the queer community, were disenfranchised and were marginalized that fought for us.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you find yourself just like comfortable?
Well, it's true. And when you put it like that, it's kind of unequivocal, because, you know, of course we have to, exactly what you said, of course we have to keep fighting this, especially when things, progress isn't always moving forwards in a kind of linear way, you know?
It's really not.
And so we do have to collectively fight. And of course a collective is made up of individuals. So it's that kind of personal responsibility. It's like, if everybody just thought, well, this isn't my fight, if everyone thought that, then we'd really be fucked.
We'd be so fucked. Well, Amelia, it's been so lovely talking to you. It's really, really nice to talk to somebody who's like, book I've read, like that's so fantastic, and I can't wait to read your next one. I just read the interview that you did with King Princess, and that was really fantastic.
Oh, thank you. She is very cool.
Yeah, she seems really cool.
Yeah. It's quite wild when you get to the point when you're like, oh, like I'm now interviewing people who are like nearly 10 years younger than me.
Yeah, oh dear. That's so wild.
And like so successful, wild. But it's good. It's, she gives me hope, you know?
She's so chic.
Yeah. We're just drifting off thinking about that now. Just like hearts in our eyes.
God, she's so hot.
She really is.
She really is. Well, Amelia, thank you so, so much for joining me and chatting with me. Where can we find you online?
Thank you for having me. Where can you find me online? You can find me on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I'm called Millie Abraham, an old moniker that I haven't quite managed to. So that's Milly Abraham. And then I guess, by Queer Intentions, if you feel so inclined, if you Google it, hopefully it will come up. Just don't buy it from Amazon. That's all.
Don't buy it from Amazon. Yeah, we'll leave that there.
Waterstones have it.
Fantastic. Yes. And also some great independent shops, I'm sure.
Yes. Gaze the word. Definitely. Have it.
Oh, that's how. Wait. Okay. We have like 5 minutes, but is that amazing to have like work that you've created in Gaze the word?
Yes, very, 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 very amazing. And they're just so kind and nice there. Yeah, when it was in the window of Gaze the Word, I slightly lost it. I was like, oh my God, this is goals.
I mean, as a queer British person, that's quite a feat, I think. I think that's really amazing.
And they do great sort of talks and stuff, and they're really supportive of authors. Yeah, I think they're wonderful.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Amelia.
No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Bye.
You've been listening to Lavender Language with your host, me, Adrian Ramirez. Sound engineered by Edmund Shaw and produced by Tawny Freda. Follow us on Instagram at Lavender Language, at Adrian.Ramirez, at Edmund_Shaw, and at Tawny Longlegs. Follow, subscribe, rate, and share. Thanks for listening.